Okay, today is September 30th, 2021. This is an oral history interview with David Appleby Sr. We are conducting this virtually over the phone. We have two interviewers and one narrator. I am Patience Stewart. I'm a historian and I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. And Kevin, we'll go to you next.
Yes, this is Kevin Taylor. I am a nuclear engineer and health physicist calling from Greenville, South Carolina.
And David?
This is David Appleby. I'm sitting here in Soldotna, Alaska, answering a bunch of questions.
Great. Now, David, how would you like your name documented for the interview?
David Appleby is fine.
Okay, all right. And what time frame did you work at SM1A?
From August of 1969 until May of 1971.
Great. And were you enlisted at the time, or were you a civilian operator?
No, I was enlisted.
You were enlisted. And what was your rank while you were there?
I was hospital corpsman first class, United States Navy.
Great. Now, tell us, how did you end up there?
There was always one Navy guy up at the SM1A. And he's kind of a cross-service fellow. And after I graduated from school, I was the environmental monitor at the SM-1 for a while. And then there was an opening. The Navy guy was transferred from the SM-1A. And when he was transferred, I got lucky and I got set up.
Nice. Had you been interested in checking out Alaska before that, or had you had spent time there?
No, I'd never spent any time there, but I'd always wanted to visit Alaska, and I thought this was a perfect opportunity.
Fantastic. So did you completed your training at SM1 in Virginia, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. Could you tell us a little bit about your experiences in the training program?
Well, that was the Army Nuclear Power Program school, and that was 1 year long, broke down into three sections. So you had a academic section of 3 months, or 4 months, excuse me, and you had a operations where you went down to the SM-1 and actually had hands-on operations, and then you had your specialty training. And my specialty training was health physics and process control.
And what all did you learn in health physics and process control?
We don't have time. Health physics is basically radiation safety. And then, of course, process control is anytime you have a power plant, waters, whether it be primary waters or secondary waters, that have to be tested and kept within limits. And that's what the process control aspect of the job was.
I see. And when you showed up at SM1A after your training, was there any additional orientation involved, or did you just jump right in?
Oh, of course, there was a lot of orientation. So I got there in August of 1969. And so there was an initial plant orientation as far as what the SM1A was all about. And then I went immediately into my specialty, which was the health physics lab. And then shortly after that, they ran you through, I went through the operations training, became a second-class operator. And then in May of 1970, I went on and became a first-class operator, a control room operator. And then in between times, I was back and forth into the health physics process control lab.
Did you have a favorite role while you were there, or anything that you particularly enjoyed doing?
Oh yeah, working in the lab. That was I'm a guy that likes numbers and I love chemistry, and that I enjoyed. I wasn't an operations guy at all. I could care less whether that thing was producing power. You know, it was just you had to go through that training just to get an idea of how the plant operated. But yeah, it was the lab work that fascinated me the most.
Sure. And what types of analyses did you do in the lab?
You had the secondary. Well, you had the primary chemistry where you looked at what was going on in the primary loop, and then you had the secondary chemistry, which is a daily process, and that was to keep We had very hard water, so we had to treat the water for hardness. And then chlorides were another thing in the secondary stage that you had to keep low in the boiler. Various levels of the water content that had to be kept at these certain levels, and you just made sure that you were doing the additions and subtractions of whatever other chemicals that we added in here to keep that within balance.
I see. Did you ever discover anything unusual in your labs?
Not as far as the secondary was concerned, or anything as far as the actual reactor. No, I didn't discover anything. It all stayed within parameters and limits. The only unusual thing that was discovered in later, just before I left up there, was the spent fuel pit. We changed out the core in 1970 and put it in the spent fuel pit. And there was a concern about the level at that time of the fuel pit. The spent fuel pit was losing water, and they were talking about it evaporating and things like that. And to me, my great discovery was the little small wet spot that was outside that happened to be contained the same level of radioactive components as did the spent fuel pit inside. And it was only a year after that they shut the plant down.
Oh, wow.
That was, I think, perhaps my most amazing discovery. And that was passed on to the upper echelon of the plant. I don't ever know what happened.
And David, what again were your years that you were there?
August of 1969 until May of 1971.
So had they made the decision to shut down the plant before you left? Were they prepping for that?
They were prepping for that. They were thinking about it. It was still, like I say, they had just changed the core out. And so everything looked like it was going to go on for a while. And then when I didn't get any word of the plant really being shut down until after I'd gotten out of the Navy, which was in 1972. And that's when they, I think, began to really decide to shut it down. But when I was there, no, it was a power producing plant.
And was the only laboratory that you... that you did in any plant-related chemistry, was the only laboratory there in the building, right in the lab next to where the turbine was?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Now I think the environmental monitor had a small lab somewhere where he did his stuff, and he wasn't part of the nuclear program. He was just a regular Army guy, and he might have had a very small lab, but it had nothing to do with us.
I see. Were there any, so you said at the time you were there, it was a fully operating plant, but then it shut down soon after in 1972. Were there any discussions about the shutdown at the time that you recall? Or was it
forward? No, I don't recall of any serious discussions.
Okay.
Just the normal scuttlebutt that goes around with a bunch of guys, is about it. There was no sit down discussions on shutting the plant down that I know of.
Sure. Do you think you could walk us through a typical day on, a typical shift while you were there?
I could probably do that. So you checked into the plant. Okay, see, let's say it's a day shift and I'm working the labs, okay? So then you come and the very first thing you can do is go and get a sample of the secondary blowdown from the generator, from the steam generator, and bring it up to the lab and run through the series of tests for on that blowdown at that time. That generally took, oh, a couple hours, I guess, and 3 hours. And after that, it was just going around the plant, and you had your times and places where you had to take your radioactive, your smears to test for radioactivity. Cleaning, and if you happen to pick up something with a little contamination, and you had to clean it up, decontaminate. You know, there was nothing ever serious. Just if you're like down in the primary lab where you did the primary chemistry, there was always a little contamination around. It had to be cleaned. It had to be decontaminated. But other than that, it was pretty much a routine thing. And then bingo, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, you went home.
And where was home for you when you were there?
We lived on post.
Mm-hmm. And you say we, were you there with your wife?
Yes, I was.
Okay. Did you have kids while you were up there too? Or?
Yes. See, I had, when I got up there, what did I have? One, two, three. I had two boys and a girl, and then I had a boy that was born when we were there. It was 1970.
Sure. What was it like for your family? Your family moving with you to Alaska and their time there?
Oh, they loved it. It was great. My wife really enjoyed it, and that was one of the things. I think Alaska was probably the reason that I only spent 10 years in the Navy. There was no reason to, after being in the state and seeing what a wonderful place it was, I didn't see any future in the Navy after that. As I said, the answer to your question, my wife enjoyed it. The thing about the nukes up there, we were different people. A lot of the people on post didn't like to associate with the radioactive people, as they say, you know. So the wives of the nuclear power group were very close knit. And the enlisted as well as the two officers' wives who was there, and so it was a special little group, and they did a lot of things, a lot of entertainment and stuff like that, which made it a nice tour for the wives.
Sure, it sounds like there was a really strong sense of community.
Yes, exactly. Most definitely, there was no question there.
Do you know why, or could you elaborate a little on why you felt like there was some separation from between your team and the rest of the installation?
Yeah, because the thought of a lot of people there was, you know, gee, they're all radioactive. Gee, they're all, you know, they're involved in that golf ball over there. You know, there was so much unknown as far as the SM1As in regard to the other people on the post that's where the big separation was.
Sure. Do you recall much of the, you know, sort of the general or public opinion about nuclear energy at the time?
Well, of course, the interesting thing was, around nuclear energy was becoming very unpopular. There hadn't been any big serious accidents or anything, but it was not something that was talked about a lot until after a couple of accidents, and then all of a sudden the activists came in, and that's when the nuclear energy really took a dip. I think that was another reason too that I wanted to leave the nuclear program, because at that time I didn't see much of a future in it. And I was probably correct to a degree, but I don't know if that answers your question off the best I could do.
Sure, absolutely. So what all did you go on to do after your time at SM1A?
I left there, went down to Fort Belvoir, back to the Navy Nuclear Power Unit, and got involved with, for the last year that I was in the Navy, it was with the Radiological Affairs Support Office, RASO. We began that. We started that. And then the Navy RTG program, the Radioisotope thermionic generator program. And so I was involved in that for several months. And then, let's see, when was it? August of 72, I was discharged.
And what did you do?
So no trips to Antarctica, to the reactor, Navy's reactor in Antarctica?
No, I never went down.
I currently work with RASO on multiple projects right now. So it's interesting that you were part of this initiation. That's good to talk to you then.
So it still exists, I'll be darned.
It sure does. When it
began, there was Lieutenant Commander. There was a Lieutenant Commander that was Dillman, Commander Dillman. A couple of chiefs, Neil Andrews, John Orr, a couple of first class, myself, Jerry Sheely. There was a civilian, I can't remember his name, big tall guy. He was a health physicist. And that was basically, and one other chief. It was, he's dead now, but I forget his name. But Wally is his first name anyway. And that was RASO.
I believe it's all civilian now. Of course, they may have a commander, that is an officer, but I believe it's all civilian.
Interesting. Also, that civilian health physicist back in 1972 said that. He says, we're going to take over this eventually. So, and it's happened. Okay.
He was right.
Anything else?
So what did you do after you were discharged? Like, how did you end up in Alaska again?
So I was discharged in August of 72, went back up to Alaska and went to work for a wholesale sporting goods company. And, so I was a salesman for them for a while. Then I went to work for, a company called Alaska Tent and Tarp, which I bought into and became a partner of. And we had a bunch of small products that we sold, but our main product was liners for every time they drill an oil well or whatever it may be. They have these huge pits, and the pits have to be lined, and we used to manufacture those. We put hundreds of thousands of square foot of liner up on the North Slope. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did until I retired in 1995. We sold the business in 95, and I retired then.
I see. Could you share some of your impressions of the overall, my question is about the Army nuclear power program, just because of our work with the Army Corps, but I'm not sure, maybe from the Navy perspective, if it's different or if you were still part of that program.
So, well, the Navy nuclear power program was shore-based, okay? It had nothing to do with propulsion. All right. The Army nuclear power program was the mainstay. The Army had the school at Fort Belvoir. Okay. It had the SM-1 training plant. They had the SM-1A. They had the MH-1A down in Gatun Lake in Panama. And they just closed down Greenland at that time. So the Army was the big guy as far as shore-based nuclear power plant. All the Navy had was the PM-3A down in the Antarctic. And so that was basically the whole existence of the Navy nuclear power program at that time was just for the PM-3A. All trained through the Army, back over to the Navy nuclear power plant, and then we went from there. But yeah, the Army was the lead for shore-based nuclear power.
Sure. Did it feel like a cohesive group?
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. Absolutely. There was never a problem. We were a tri-service, of course. There was Air Force was involved also because of the, I think it was a PM-1 up in Wyoming, Sundance, Wyoming, with the Air Force nuclear power plant up there. And it was Army, Navy, and Air Force.
Great. Do you want to talk a little bit more about the culture or camaraderie among the program or among the SM-1A operators?
We all like to hunt and fish, which we did a lot of. Like to party. We had a lot of SM1A parties, a lot of them. Every couple of 3 months, but the whole group would get together. We'd go to the Rod and Gun Club. And that was basically it, you know. But most of the time, when you had time off, your crew members and your friends, we were out hunting or fishing. But that's what you come to Alaska for.
Sure. Kevin, do you have more questions?
What's that again, please?
Oh, I was asking Kevin if he wanted to fill in with any questions.
Well, no. I think one I would have, we like to check with the our interviewees and see how their experience at the at SM1A impacted the rest of their career. And you said you got out of the nuclear business, but you ended up back in Alaska. Was that just a happenstance, or did you look to return to Alaska because of the time you spent at the SM1A? And so is that what drew you back there, or was it just because that's where the opportunity was?
No, your second comment was the correct one. Once we came to Alaska and experienced it, I mean, I'm talking about driving into it. The very first time that first of all, driving through, seeing the Rocky Mountains and going through the Rockies up into Alaska, I said, man, this is where I want to live. And then once we were here, once we were at Greeley, just a couple of months, it became obvious, even though winter was coming on, it became obvious that this was going to be probably our future home, the state of Alaska was. Mm-hmm.
We've heard some other. Go ahead, Kevin.
But you said you had one of your children was born while you were there. I've been to Delta Junction and recently, but I can't imagine it looks much different today than it did 30, 40 years ago. Not a lot of medical facilities off post, but how did that go? And I assume your wife was on board with this whole thing.
Right. The minute she became close, she started to get a little bit of labor. They threw her on a C-47 Chinook helicopter and flew to Bassett Army Hospital up in Fairbanks.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. The doc at the dispensary there in Fort Greeley said, "No way. Get her out of here.
We're not doing this." Were there?
So that's interesting.
Yeah, and then there was two and a half weeks before she finally delivered. But anyway.
So she got a free helicopter ride, huh?
Yeah, right. Exactly. That was in June 1970.
Very interesting.
We've heard a lot.
Those are the kind of stories that really seem to make the work experience there unique. Obviously, well beyond as you mentioned before, having a specific group that was focused on a specific task that was something very unique in its nature alone with the nuclear power. But the stories that we've heard of the uniqueness of being at the on post at Fort Greeley as well have been very enlightening.
The waking up at night, with this terrible, terrible noise of almost like thunder, and you look out your window and there's about 10 buffalo in your yard, and the noise is one of the buffalo is scratching his back on the dumpster, and he's picking the dumpster up and dropping it, picking it up and dropping it. I mean, where in the world could that happen? But there. But anyway, that was a little off track on that story.
Not at all. We've heard some of the interviewees comment that they really just could not handle the cold and the winters there. And certainly that wasn't the case for you and your family. Do you have anything to say about wintering there?
Oh, none at all. My wife and I both were born and brought up in Vermont, northern Vermont. So, you know, yeah, granted, we might have experienced 30 or 35 below zero up in northern Vermont. And then, of course, we get to Alaska, you know, and in the winter, it's 50 below, 60 below zero. But it was cold as cold. That's what they have clothes for. See, unlike heat, where you can only take off so much. Whereas cold, you can put on as much as you want.
Sure. Well, I'm so
happy. Yeah, the cold was not, that wasn't a problem at all for us anyway.
Well, I'm so happy to hear that you were able to find your home out of this experience.
I wouldn't give it up for $1 million. It was a great opportunity, and the only reason that I got the, normally they didn't send a health physics guy up there, and maybe didn't do it generally, either a mechanic or an electrician, but there was a sergeant major at the SM1 he was a former Navy guy during World War II. So him and I used to talk when I was an environmental monitor there, and when he found out that I was interested, I had no chance to go up. Sergeant Major Cecil. Anyway, he pulled a few strings for me behind the scenes, and I've been forever grateful for that.
Got you to Alaska. Wow. Are you still in contact with anyone from the program?
No. Well, I go to the reunions. And the last reunion we had was, 3 years ago now, but see, COVID interrupted the 2020 and then 21, again, the same thing. So, but there I see Doug McCarty, Bill France, Billy Joe Foreman, Frank Faulkner, you know, they generally attend the reunion. So I'm not on a contact, I don't contact them every day, you know.
Sure.
Except for the
reunion. You see them there. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah. Did you ever have you ever been able to get hold of the old commanding officer up there at SM1A? He retired, Colonel Dorr, John Dorr.
I don't have his contact information, but is he part of the reunions? Because we are in contact with.
Well, no, I haven't talked to John since 2004. I get hold of him just by accident through the alumni of West Point. He's a West Point graduate, and I got to talk to him then. Yeah, major. He was a major then, and probably as far as I'm concerned, one of the finest officers I ever served with. I mean, he was a phenomenal man, great guy. But anyway, he was there. He came up about a month before I did in 69, and he left about a month before I did in 71. So we were there for the whole time. But yeah, he's back on the East Coast somewhere, I think Virginia. But
okay. And would you mind spelling his last name for me?
Sure. It's Dorr.
Okay.
John Dorr. And I say he retired as a colonel in the United States Army. And he was I don't know what branch he was in when he retired or whatever, but he was a ranger. Anyway, he was a great guy.
Great. We will see if we can look him up.
Yep.
Are there any other experiences from SM1A or Fort Greely that you'd like to share?
Yeah, the only thing is that it's a damn lot of them are dead. Mm-hmm. As you saw that list that I sent you, I mean, it's amazing the number of guys that died. And the number of cancers, that was another thing. And that was probably one of the hardest jobs. The military, they've got this mentality, okay? It's called mission. Got to do the missions, okay? So if we have problems with the control rod drives or something of the sort, and the mechanics would have to get out and work on it, I had to be conscious all the time on them, because they would hide their dosimeters. And I never was able to get the exact amount of radiation that those guys sucked out, but I was always sneaking around trying to catch them, and I'd catch them. And all the guys that were responsible for it all died of some weird form of cancer. And I mean, that's the only amazing thing. I could list off their names here. they just never listen. But anyway, that's probably the most frustrating part of the entire association with the program is I guess you can almost look at those guys like the anti-vaxxers for the vaccines. I mean, I know radiation, they say, is terrible, all this, but boy, we got to get this job done, you know?
And so they would hide their dosimeters because they were so tied to the mission, and they even though they knew...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'd have to go down and you had a lot of streaming radiation down there in those pits. So I'd go down there and figure out, and some of it was getting really high streams. And I'd put out my tape where the streams were, you know, so those guys knew what to work around. Turn you back, bingo. They're right here, right in the middle of it, you know, just working away. Got to get it fixed, you know. I said, okay. But,
Did you ever have to respond to, you know, an overexposure situation?
No. none of my crews or none of my guys ever got overexposed. And the ones that would list it and follow directions, but I have no idea the ones that hid their dosimeters or their film badges, you know, what they got.
I see, yeah.
No idea whatsoever. Mm. I think we were allowed that time as a 3-year. I think it was one rad. That was a long time ago. Go ahead.
Kevin, do you have any more questions?
Nope. I do not.
You don't? Okay. And David, do you have anything else you'd like to share?
No, not really. Well, not on tape, anyway.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to do this interview, and we really appreciate your service to the program, and I'm glad that you had such an enjoyable experience while you were there and were able to make your home in Alaska.
I'm glad to participate. If there's any questions or anything come popping up that you're curious about, just email me and I'll be more than glad to answer it.
Okay. All right. I will go ahead and conclude the interview and stop recording.